Joshua Blue Buse is an independent scholar and the author of Bigfoot, The Life and Times of a Legend. He told Steve Paulson why he wrote a book about Bigfoot, even though he doesn't believe the creature exists.
It's interesting to me that there's this thing, this idea of Bigfoot that we could all talk about, we could all reference, and it immediately evokes certain images in our head, so that while Bigfoot may not exist as a creature running through the forests of the Pacific Northwest, there's no doubt that Bigfoot exists as a thing in our culture.
How far back does the legend of Bigfoot go?
Depending on how broadly you want to define the subject, you could find wild men creatures in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is the first written story we have. People who are more partisan about Bigfoot might trace it back to Native American tales, mythologies, and legends that also talk about these half-human, half-beast creatures. In my opinion, you don't really start getting Bigfoot as we know him, really until the 1950s.
Well, it's fascinating to think that this legend, I mean, this thing that we all know about, suddenly exploded in popularity, I guess you would say, in the 1950s. So how do you explain that?
That was one of the things that really drew me to this story, because when I first came to it, my full expectation would be that I would be kind of steeping myself in Native American legendary. When I looked at the story, there wasn't that connection there at all. And so what it seems to me, if I could do a quick gloss on it, you had the story come out of Northern California that there was a creature that they were calling Bigfoot rummaging around construction sites. And the story got a little bit of local play, but then was picked up by the newswires in October of 1958 and rocketed around the world, and was a momentary story. It was kind of a flash in the pan at the time, but it was interesting. But then it got picked up by what were at the time called men's adventure magazines. And these were magazines such as Argosy and True and Men and Mail that catered to a primarily working class male audience. And for various reasons, the stories about Bigfoot were appealing to this audience and could be shaped to fit into these magazines. And so then became kind of a constant presence throughout the late 1950s and 1960s in these magazines, and then was picked up again in the 1970s in another new form of communication. This was what was called four-walling movies.
What are four-walling movies?
Four-walling movies. This was an innovation in movie techniques done in the early 1970s by a number of primarily Western-based small independent film companies. And what they saw was that rural audiences were not being catered to by Hollywood, and so they decided to start making their own movies, and then they would show them in Elks clubs or in local theaters if they were high schools, and they would rent the whole theater when there was a theater. So they were renting all four walls, as it were, and so they became christened four-wallers.
Hmm. So going back to the 1950s, when magazines started writing these remarkable tales of Bigfoot, does raise the question of whether these magazine editors actually believed the stories of Bigfoot, or was it just a way to sell more copies?
It's pretty clear now it was entirely to sell more copies. These magazines were very ardent in that they presented themselves as true and as authentic, and these were true stories. As a number of the people who worked on these magazines have since admitted, the stories were invented whole cloth. They invented stories about World War II. There was never any concern for authenticity.
It almost sounds like you're saying that the magazines are what created the Bigfoot phenomenon, at least in this country.
I think the magazines are, in a lot of ways, what perpetuated it and brought it to popular consciousness, yes. If you hadn't had this kind of magazine system, it strikes me that it's very unlikely that the story would have ever jumped out from a small local story to become something nationwide. As it is, we have a lot of monsters, local lore about monsters all across the country, but it's Bigfoot that is, as one book put it, America's number one monster. It's the monster that we all know about.
Hmm. You also write that Bigfoot's popularity really took off in the 1960s and 70s, and it was especially popular among white working class men. How do you explain that?
What I think was happening is that the stories about Bigfoot, as they were being told in a lot of the men's magazines that were popular at the time and in some of the independent films that were being produced at the time, these stories ended up reflecting on certain experiences that white working class men were having, and so that they could both see Bigfoot as a symbol of themselves, in that here was a creature that was feeling attacked and maybe near extinct, and was a holdover from an older time, which sometimes they felt themselves to be at a time when there were protests over the Vietnam War, when the civil rights activities were so momentous, that they could see themselves as Bigfoot, as a creature from another time that was a holdover and that was being circumscribed by the world. And at other times they could see the Bigfoot as the aggressor, as the thing that was attacking them. There is an unfortunate history in this country of linking apes to African Americans. And this was also occurred in the Bigfoot literature, where you would see Bigfoot sometimes likened to African Americans. And as I said, the stories reflected a lot of their experiences.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have spent a fair amount of time with members of the Bigfoot community. Were there any particular people who you found especially interesting?
I don't know that I'm 100% comfortable answering that question.
Without giving details, why? I'm curious.
The book's reception among the Bigfoot community has been, I mean, some of the people are interesting, but not always in ways that I appreciate.
They've gotten kind of angry at you for saying that Bigfoot doesn't exist.
Yes. One gentleman in particular has taken to the internet and claims that my book is a literary fraud. And in a way, he kind of ended up accidentally supporting my hypothesis, because one of his attempts to really knock me down was to claim that I was gay, which kind of goes to show that, yeah, interest in Bigfoot is tightly correlated with anxieties about masculinity.
Wow. So things are kind of dicey out there. You have to be a little careful about what you say.
The Bigfoot community is hard to call it a community. It's very riven by a lot of tensions. You do have to weigh what you're saying and know which audience you're speaking to. And yeah, Bigfooters hold grudges for a long time.
Hmm. Now, has the nature of the reported sightings changed over the decades? I mean, is the Bigfoot that we hear about today more or less the same as the Bigfoot that was reported back in the 1950s?
No, and I think this might actually go back to one of your earlier questions. What you'll see in the 1970s depictions of Bigfoot, especially, Bigfoot was a rampaging monster. It would attack people. Many of the more recent, I guess you would say, reports about Bigfoot are actually about its docility and about the fact that some families have been able to keep Bigfoot tribes, I guess for lack of a better word, Bigfoot groups under observation for a long time and have been able to communicate with the beast. And so that the creature becomes more of a gentle giant than it used to be.
How do you account for that?
Well, I think part of that is kind of piping Bigfoot through environmentalism, where Bigfoot now in a lot of ways stands in for a concern about the environment. And I think in the 1980s, especially, you'll see Bigfoot had gotten picked up into a lot of much more middle-class publications. The example being Harry and the Hendersons, where Bigfoot was very much tamed. And so you have a new kind of mass media vision of what Bigfoot is. And so then we tell ourselves stories about Bigfoot that are different. And so if you have a gentle giant, if you have a defender of the earth, then that creature needs to be approached differently than if you had a monster held over from primeval times looking to scrape by.
Do you think Bigfoot is with us for years to come, decades to come?
I think in one form or another, Bigfoot will continue to be with us for quite some time, yes. The creature exists right on the edge of the things that we know and we don't know, and there's always going to be something that we don't know. I think it's even possible, maybe speculative, but possible to kind of project the image forward and see it in alien life forms. If you imagine one day we're exploring another planet, Mars, say, and I have a strong sense that we're going to hear stories that there's just beyond the edge of vision, that there's some creature that the first explorers have seen, and these stories are going to come back to us, and they're going to be much like Bigfoot, and that maybe we'll find what look like footprints in the red dust of Mars. And so I think that you'll always have something like this Bigfoot creature with us, yes.
Joshua Blue Buse is the author of Bigfoot, The Life and Times of a Legend.